Radio EcoShock.
Welcome back to Radio EcoShock. We are mulling over a dinner meeting, a call for brain power, with guest Jack Alpert and six other bright green minds of Vancouver. The topics, as always, are how bad is it and what the hell are we going to do? Jack Alpert has explained why it's rapid population decline or bust. We only have a short time left to make a drastic reduction in population within the next 10 years, or utter chaos and mass dying will overtake much of the world. We'll start with host Rex Wyler, a mind much respected in Vancouver and around the world for his work with Greenpeace, as an organizer of Peak Oil, and as an author. Should we forget about consumption and just talk extreme population reduction? Let's talk with Rex Wyler. He's the co-founder of Greenpeace. He's the author of the truly authoritative history of that organization. Rex is on the Vancouver Peak Oil Executive, and his writing is published all over the place. Rex, I want to try like a nutshell of Jack Alpert's arguments on consumption, and his first point might be nobody here in the developed world is going to give up their cushy lifestyle, and that seems sort of true enough at this point. And second, everybody in the developing world wants the same lifestyle, and there's no way to stop them. And third, and this is his key point, I suppose, even if reducing consumption could work, it's too slow. By the time we make the changes required, the planet is toast climatically and biologically. So what's your response to that, Rex?
Well, the human situation is this. We are in what we call in ecology, we call habitat overshoot. That means there's too many humans consuming too much stuff for the habitat. Now, our habitat happens to be our entire planet, so there's nowhere else to go. And in habitat overshoot, what a species has to do, there's only one solution, and that's consume less stuff. Now, you can consume less stuff by having less people. You can consume less stuff by each person consuming less. Unfortunately, we already have, you know, most of humanity is living very modest and poor lives. It would be certainly feel unfair to ask those people to consume less. So really, we're down to asking the wealthy consumers, like most of us in Canada, for example, to consume less stuff, which is a reasonable assumption. Jack's approach in terms of talking about population is certainly true that one way to solve the problem of overshoot is to reduce the population, which I believe is something we have to do. I do not share Jack's belief that this can be done quickly in any way whatsoever. I think the reduction of the human population is going to happen over a long period of time, and I think it necessarily will take a long period of time, and therefore we have to raise the issue of consumption as well.
And he sort of is suggesting that we should try and shoot for a number, he suggests 100 million, where everybody could live basically the way they do now. I mean, maybe they'd be in electric cars instead of gas cars, but they could fly around on biofuels, or we would live the way we live now. And do you feel that's a realistic view?
No, I don't think it's a realistic view because, for one, I don't think we're not going to get down to 100 million human population anytime soon. Secondly, we cannot create the lifestyle we live now with 100 million people on the planet. You have to account for what does it take to actually have a high-tech economy. We're digging lithium out of the ground, you know, in places like Canada and Afghanistan, shipping it all over the world to build batteries and so forth. We're digging precious metals and rare earth metals from all over the world, shipping it around, massive manufacturing and production facilities and refining facilities and so forth. So you cannot necessarily scale down the top consumers in the global economy and think that those top consumers can carry on their lifestyle without everybody else who's actually supporting them underneath. In other words, we have the lifestyle that we live in Canada, for example, really depends on and requires farmers in Mexico, miners in Afghanistan and Africa, loggers in South America and Indonesia and so forth. So it's a little bit naive to assume that you could take, say, 100 million people and have them all consuming at the level of, say, your average Canadian without this full global infrastructure.
But it does seem like mainstream environment groups have stopped talking about population as an issue, maybe too hot to handle, or maybe it just can't be, you can't do anything with it right now. Do you think it's time to change that?
Oh, absolutely. I think environmental groups have to talk about population. I'm glad that for example, that Jack is raising this issue, because it's absolutely critical. It's important. I've never stopped talking about population as an issue. We have to stabilize and reduce human population. Some environmental groups have avoided this issue because it's very politically sensitive. People are afraid of something like the China solution of draconian government legislation prohibiting children and so forth. But here's one key secret to this whole population question is this. It can be solved without draconian government laws. You can improve the population growth level simply through women's rights, number one, and making contraception available worldwide. If contraception is available and if women have a choice over their own reproductive lifestyles, the human population will automatically go down. The birth rate will go down. This has been shown, this has been proven all over the world. So we can address the population in ways that do not necessarily result in injustice or individual loss of freedom. But we do have to understand that our concept of freedom is limited by what the Earth can provide. And the Earth cannot provide an infinite amount of resources for an infinite amount of people or a growing number of people. So yes, we have to reduce the human population. We have to stabilize it first. Right now we're adding about 80 million people a year. That would be like 40 cities the size of Vancouver. We're adding to the planet every year. This is just absolutely unsustainable. We can't even keep up with the infrastructure for those people, which is one reason why there are so many people going hungry and living on the edge of poverty.
Jack Alpert's vision is based on the possibility of a major crash or a great die-off. He thinks that will happen by whatever means, because it must happen for us to survive. Do you think that's a possibility?
Well, I think it's more than a possibility. I think the die-off is already underway. There's about a billion people living on the edge of starvation on the planet. There's about 9 million people starve to death every year, literally starve to death. That's about 24,000-25,000 a day. That's 1,000 people an hour. So the die-off is well underway. And currently we cannot sustain the human population as it is. Now, some people will point to the fact that, well, there's lots of food, so therefore it's a distribution problem. Well, this is true. It is a distribution problem. The distribution problem, however, means that if we're going to share the food equally, then the people in Canada and the United States and the wealthy countries, the wealthy people of the world, are going to have to give up a share of their food wealth. This is something I don't see happening anywhere. I don't get a sense that anybody's willing to do that. I mean, some of us, many people like myself and others, are living more modest lifestyles and consuming less meat and consuming less in general, but this would have to be a massive undertaking to make a difference. But yes, I believe that the industrial society as we know it will collapse. I believe it's already in the process of collapse. I think the influences of peak oil and peak energy and peak commodities in general, the impact of global warming, impact of population growth and crowding and conflict and so forth will in fact cause the civilization as we know it to collapse. It's happened many times before in human history. We have not learned the lessons of human history. You know, the civilizations have collapsed in Mesopotamia, on Easter Island, the Mayan civilization, many civilizations throughout history. In fact, almost all civilizations, the Roman Empire and so forth, have all grown too big, too fast, and collapsed. So the idea that that can happen on a global scale is not a stretch at all. It can happen on a global scale, and I think it will. Yeah, so our communities that learn to live a more modest lifestyle, more locally supplied, local self-reliance, localization, growing your local food and so forth, those communities will be the ones that are more resilient and able to survive.
And what about you, Rex Weiler? Are you working on another book, or do you have a project you want to tell us about upcoming?
Well, I'm constantly working on environmental, ecological issues, doing research and writing. I publish a column called Deep Green, and your listeners can just Google my name, Rex Weiler, and Deep Green, and you'll get my column at the Greenpeace website. And I'm working on a book on ecology and economics, because I believe that this is going to be the issue of the coming century, will be the reconciling human enterprise and human economics with ecological reality. So I'm working on that project.
We've just had a short chat with Rex Weiler, a Greenpeace founder, historian, activist, and author. Find out more at rexweiler.com, and that's spelled W-E-Y-L-E-R. Thank you so much, Rex.
Hey, thanks a lot. I really appreciate it, Alex.
That was Greenpeace co-founder and historian Rex Weiler. Now we go for a woman's perspective. Wherever I go to record The Big Picture, The Real Deal, it seems like Vandy Savage is almost always there, not as a spectator, but as an organizer. She works crowds, she works people, and she works small miracles. This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with Canadian ecologist Vandy Savage. You were at a dinner meeting with Jack Alpert, who has got some radical ideas about population reduction. And it seemed to me part of Jack's plan to reduce population was to persuade grandmothers, maybe to stop pressuring women to have kids. What was your reaction?
Well, certainly you can pressure people to not have children. China has done this, and they have a population fertility rate at about 1.8, 1.6. So that worked. It's a legal restriction, but there's all kinds of weirdness that's attached to that. For example, there's a lot of female infanticide because in that culture, men are considered much more important. And so if you're a 30-year-old male in China, there are not enough women, so now they're importing them from Korea and so forth. I'm not sure that's the wisest solution. In my view, a different solution is when you give women education and access to birth control, by themselves, women will have a lower fertility rate. In fact, I was just reading in our local newspaper, the Vancouver Sun, today in a column by Craig and Mark Kilberger, that in a meeting with the Dalai Lama, it was discussed that one single year of primary education for a girl, and they're referring to girls in India, can reduce fertility by 10%. And increases their ability to earn wages by 10 to 20%. To me, the much more humane way to approach a radical reduction in population is a radical effort to educate women and give them easy, cheap, free access to birth control and support women in the world. That benefits us, it benefits our mothers, our sisters, our spouses, whomever it is. It's humane, and I also think as we do this and we become more equal, that we have a shot at world peace because we'll be born balanced.
I think men have a role to play, though. I know that, for example, when I was down in Mexico, I had many men bragging to me that they had 8 or 10 children. That was sort of the mark of them as a successful man, and we see that in many cultures, and it exists in our own culture. So there have to be adjustments to, I think, with men.
I agree, and I think machismo, which is really what you're referring to, is I'm so macho that the more kids I have, it's proof of my you know, virility. I think as women in our feminist movement, we have done men a huge disservice by not including them, because personally, I love men. I have 2 sons. I think men are fabulous. So your point is well taken. How do we redefine what is manly, what is machismo, what is virile? Because there's a lot of ways to do that that don't necessarily include having large numbers of children of proof of your manliness. I agree with you, Alex, and I think as women, we need to do a much better job letting our men know that we love them when we think they're awesome. And I think as men, we need to redefine how warriors, protectors, and all the things that men can offer, how that meshes with this new world that we're trying to create. You're right. We need to not exclude men.
Are you finding more women concerned about overpopulation, and what sorts of things might they say?
Well, most of the women in my group have had 2 children or less willfully, on purpose, not accidentally, because many of us read Paul Ehrlich's The Population Bomb. At this point, he was projecting we'd have 15 billion people on the planet. So that has greatly changed everything. In my view, the number one most fantastic invention of the last 100 years is birth control. Nothing to do with computers or the internet. So that's my perspective. But I think women really aren't going to choose to have fewer children unless they have other options in their life, because our primary option, where we are honored and where we are respected, is for things like Mother's Day. So it's being a mother where we gain respect. As soon as we gain respect as scientists and writers and travelers and adventurers as well as mothers, then that allows us to have community and social respect, not solely based on our ability to raise children.
Vandy, I'm so glad I called you because you said that really, really well. Is there anything you'd like to add, any projects you want to tell us about?
Well, right now I am working on a project with a really dear friend of mine, Terry. We're writing a project for young girls to empower girls to see and form the world in a new way. And hopefully we're presenting it to one of the women who was the founder of Discovery Channel, and we're just in the final stages of writing this. So in my view, what I would like to do with my life is not only be a political activist, which I am, and a fervent political activist, and not only walk the talk, I am trying to reduce my carbon footprint to as small as possible every day of my life, questioning my choices, which I screw up all the time. But I also am working for women's equality, and to your point, how do we have men fitting into this? As I mentioned, I have two sons who I love dearly, and I don't want them shunted out of the picture. And then the final thing, though, is how can we dream and vision a new way of living together? Because it is only in doing that, in living sustainably within community, that we visualize that, that we'll be able to create this vision and other people will be able to see it and say, wow, that sounds good. I want to be there. You mean shopping doesn't have to be my pastime? Maybe it's something really cool like looking at the stars at night? So I believe that we have to create a new vision because most people cannot see something that they've never seen before. So those of us that have an inkling can create this vision and make it so desirable that people are willing to change their current behavior and move toward this new way of living on the planet.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. We've been talking with green ecologist Vandy Savage. Thank you so much, Vandy.
You're welcome. My pleasure.
My thanks to Vandy Savage for doing her first radio interview. Now on to a veteran of Radio EcoShock, and by that I mean I've recorded every speech of Dr. Bill Reese I could get my hands on. His mind, which helped invent the whole idea of the ecological footprint, is a mind which teaches me new things every time I listen to him. Bill Reese is a planetary gem. Just joining us, we have the co-inventor of the concept of the ecological footprint, Dr. William Reese from the University of British Columbia. Professor Reese, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Well, thank you very much.
First of all, humans are in a biological condition known as overshoot. We are consuming more than our resource base can sustain. Did you recently raise your estimate on how far beyond carrying capacity we are now?
I didn't personally, but we continue through something called the Global Footprint Network, which is actually run by one of my former PhD students, Matthias Wackernagel. Every 2 years, we undertake an analysis of the ecological footprints of nations and compare the aggregate consumption by the world's nations to the available, what we call biocapacity, the productive capacity of the planet, both to produce renewable resources and to assimilate waste such as carbon dioxide. And in the last few years, we've gone from roughly 30% to a 50% overshoot.
What does that mean? Could you just quickly tell us, what does that really mean for us?
Well, suppose you've got, let's say, $1 million in the bank, and it's returning 5% interest. That means that every year you could live on about $50,000 a year. And if you didn't spend any more than that, you'd be living on sustainable income. Okay, so $1 million in the bank at 5% per year returns $50,000 a year. You're not in a state of overshoot. But supposing you spend $60,000 a year, that means you're spending 20% more than your annual income of $50,000 a year. Now, you can keep doing that for a while because obviously you've got $1 million in the bank. But every year you expend more than the interest earned by your capital, you're reducing the capital. So in subsequent years, the capital won't be producing as much. So in effect, we've gone from spending 30% more than our annual interest to spending 50% more than our annual interest. And this means that we're continually and at an accelerating rate depleting the natural assets of the planet that produce vital resources for our survival. So the soils are being eroded, the waste sinks, the carbon sink capacity is vastly overfilled, which is why carbon dioxide is accumulating in the atmosphere. Fisheries are collapsing, and deserts are expanding. So the habitable, productive land and waterscapes, the productive ecosystems required for human sustainability, are being reduced, even as we increase our demands every year.
Recently, we heard a presentation by Jack Alpert. Jack claims we need a rapid population decline to live modern lifestyles or perhaps to survive at all on a habitable planet. What is your reaction to this proposal to make rapid population decline our frontline priority?
Well, if you think of the ecological footprint, it's the demand that a population makes on the ecosystems. So two things are involved. One is population. The other is per capita consumption. So the human impact is a product of the total population times average per capita consumption. So Jack is perfectly correct. Population is one of the major contributors to that impact. But if we compare the contribution from population growth now to the contribution from rising material standards, rising consumption, population on the planet is growing at about 1%, a little less than 1% per year. Consumption growth is increasing at 2, 3, 4% per year, depending on where you look. So actually right now, consumption is driving the increase in the human footprint more rapidly than is population. You can't ignore either of them, but to isolate population as the only factor is an error and perhaps not the best step we could take.
Very good. Well, you have, Bill Reese, a new paper out published in the journal Sustainability, Science, Practice, and Policy. The title is What's Blocking Sustainability, Human Nature, Cognition, and Denial. Can you tell us about that, please?
Well, it's a very complex argument. It takes me back to my biological roots. And my dilemma in trying to understand how an allegedly intelligent species, one capable of looking at the data, of using rational analysis to understand what those trends mean, how can that species, when we see explosive growth in just about everything, including an accelerating climate change, how can we continue to reinforce the economic models and the various instruments of growth that are putting us in that dilemma? Why is it that we seem incapable of seeing the writing on the wall and making the changes in society necessary to bring us into a sustainable state? So if you ask that question, you have to go quite deep. Obviously, the superficial problem is the growing consumption of energy and resources. That's driven by two things. I argue that it's driven first by the natural human predisposition. It's a genetically driven predisposition to expand, to fill all available space. You know, our species has just about the widest geographic range of any advanced animal on the planet. So we've been enormously successful at occupying the planet. But we share another trait with all other species, and that's the tendency to consume all accessible resources. And in the human case, accessibility is really defined by technology. The better our technology, the more oil we can get, the more gold we can get. We can refine ever weaker or poorer qualities of ore, for example. So humans are on this track of expanding to fill all the space and using all of the resources, and that's an enormous driver to ecological destruction. But things are worse than that because it's reinforced by a cultural paradigm, if you like, or a cultural narrative based exclusively on growing the economy. So for at least the last 60 years, virtually every government and every major international agency has as the principal plank in its development platform increasing economic growth, which really means increasing the scale of the material economy, the sheer size of material and energy flows through the economy. So on the one hand, then, you have biology giving us a predisposition to grow and a cultural model reinforcing that. So in some sense, we're in the worst of all possible worlds. When you realize that the human enterprise, that is to say, all of humanity, this, what is it now, 6.8 billion people, and all of the artifacts and infrastructure of our big cities and so on and so forth, all of this is growing at a very rapid rate, 2, 3, 4% per year on a finite planet, which is in effect shrinking because we're despoiling the resources, wrecking the ecosystems, degrading the landscape. Well, anyone with a modicum of intelligence could argue that this isn't sustainable, that it can't go on forever, and yet we don't seem to organize ourselves politically or even personally to change the perceptions and behaviors that we engage in as a culture, as a society, in ways that would override the natural predisposition to expand. So the only way we're going to solve this problem is to give up on growth, to introduce global population policies, and to redistribute income so that consumption is redistributed. Half the human population is currently malnourished to some degree. Half are satisfied, and a billion people overweight. Well, that's an inequity that has to be resolved. And so if we're really serious about sustainability, it does mean stopping growth, redistributing wealth and income globally, and reducing population growth. In fact, we have to shrink the human population to survive equitably and sustainably on this planet.
But do we have the tools to do this mentally? Do we have the brain power? I mean, it's very well for the scientists to say, look, you're in big trouble. And as you've said, they've been saying that for several decades. But we've got these urges, these...
Well, that's exactly my argument, that we're not doing it because, first of all, because of those primitive expansionist urges. But we can change the developmental paradigm. We don't have to reinforce that gross biology. Right now, both nature and nurture are working against us. At the very least, if we exercise our intelligence, it should be able to overcome the natural instincts and the emotional attachment we have to the growth syndrome. If it can't do that, then I think we really are in very serious trouble. Nobody said this is a solvable problem. And I think we have to recognize that many, many previous cultures faced similar dilemmas and have either refused or have been unable to address them and hence have collapsed. So that this is yet another test of human beings as a conflicted species. Will our intellectual understanding, will our capacity for logic and reason finally outweigh our natural predispositions to expand and our tendency to believe in cultural myths such as the growth myth? And right now, there's no evidence that intelligence will outweigh those other dimensions of human nature. So I'm not saying this is a solvable problem at all. I am saying that one key to its solution is recognition of what I call the distal causes are in our human nature and in our cultural narratives, and use that knowledge to, I suppose, educate the public to be prepared to accept such things as full cost pricing. Gasoline should cost in Canada $6 or $8 a liter, perhaps $20 a gallon in the U.S. That's the true social cost of using it. And if people were willing to accept that, the economy would change overnight in the direction of being more sustainable. That's just one example of many things that would have to happen, but they would be consistent with the analysis that I'm giving you. So far, we're not willing to do that. We're so entrenched in our existing ways, it's become a neural pattern, a cognitive block to moving forward. We simply are in denial about how serious this crisis is, and we've even got a multi-million-dollar denialist industry, in effect funded by the corporate oil and corporate coal, to keep people in the dark, to prevent us from rising to the level of public intelligence that would enable truly sustainable policies to be put in place.
There's so much more to all of this.
There is. We could go on all day.
I know we could and we can't, but I hope we could do a longer interview with you at a later date. But I really thank you for chipping in on this conversation. We've just heard from Dr. Bill Reese. He's the co-inventor of the concept of the ecological footprint. He's with the School of Regional and Community Planning at the University of British Columbia in Canada. Thank you so much, Dr. Reese.
My pleasure. Thank you.
All the audio you heard today was recorded by Alex Smith of Radio EcoShock. Feel free to spread it around. Please do. Help dig us out of this hole. Maybe our guests next week can shed more light. Dr. Paul Ehrlich, author of The Population Bomb, is scheduled to join us, talking about his new book. I'll also have the senior editor of Grist magazine, Lisa Hymas, with her plan to help the population problem. So take heart. Maybe we'll muddle through, even if Jack says we won't. I'm Alex Smith. Get all our past programs from the website ecoshock.org. Thank you for working your brain.